are listening to the Gorman Bear Girls podcast. We're just two girls making memories and eating our way through life together. Welcome to our table. Hi, I'm Star.
And I'm Jen.
And we are the Gorman Bear Girls.
Hey everyone, Star and I would love to welcome you to a very special table today. It's located at the Oaklander Hotel on the 10th floor in Spirits and Tales Restaurant. It's where we had the chance to interview Executive Chef Jessica Lewis. You are going to love all of the wonderful things that she has to share with us today. We were able to speak with her outside on that gorgeous patio that they have. But because we were outside, we want you to know our sound probably won't sound like it normally does when we record in the studio. You'll hear some echoes in the mic and maybe some outside noises. Regardless, we know you're going to hang on to every word. She was fantastic to interview, and she talks all about her new adventure at Spirits and Tales Restaurant. We really hope you enjoy the interview. And hey, go over to Spirits and Tales and grab yourself something great to eat when you're done listening. You will not regret it. It's amazing. Enjoy the interview.
Hey, Star.
Hey, Jen. How are you?
I'm doing really well. How are you?
I'm doing well as well.
So why are we so well today?
I don't know.
We are at someone else's table today.
We are.
Which is an honor.
It is.
We are with Executive Chef Jessica Lewis.
Hi.
Welcome, Jessica.
Thanks.
At her brand new restaurant, Spirits and Tales, located in the Oaklander Hotel. Oakland?
Yes, on the
Pittsburgh,
10th floor.
On the 10th floor.
With incredible views. We're outside today on the terrace, which is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, so if you hear extra background noise, that's why. There are some buses down below, some helicopters up above. And yeah, we're just rolling with it.
Yeah.
We are on location today.
We are.
So welcome, Jessica.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me today.
Oh,
thanks
for being with us.
Yeah. I'm excited to be outside and not in the kitchen.
Yeah.
We were just talking about vitamin D, and I'm hoping it's coming down a little bit.
Yeah. Do you want us to do this every week so
yes.
you can get out of the kitchen for an hour or something?
I would love to sit out here. Have an excuse.
I know.
To sit
it's
out
a
here.
Beautiful space. I was super surprised when we came that people weren't sitting out here,
because
we were talking about that prior to recording, that we all feel like we'd be out here with a cup of coffee, a glass of wine, your laptop, like whatever. It's just a beautiful space.
It's a little gem tucked away.
It is.
Yeah.
With gorgeous
beautiful.
View of Oakland. You can see the cathedral. You can see part
Shenley
of Phipps.
Park.
You can see Shenley. You can see Soldiers and Sailors. Who knew Oakland was so beautiful from high above?
I know. It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And anyone who listens to our podcast regularly, we heard us talk about the grand opening of Spirits and Tales, which we raved about because it was amazing.
Ooh.
Yeah, we did. We've actually raved about you on multiple occasions.
Oh.
Yeah. See, we've been talking about, we've been setting you up for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so great.
I need to go back and listen to that then to hear what you said about me.
Uh-oh, yeah.
All of your accolades.
Yeah.
Yes. All right, so tell us a little bit about your background, how you decided you wanted to be a chef, because we heard that you actually have a degree in, is it economics?
I do.
Yeah, and so how do you, you know, go from economics to being
food.
A chef?
Yeah. Wow, yeah, this is a, it was a, quite a change for me to kind of jump into something completely different, especially from my family. I don't have like a grandmother that made pasta or a grandfather that did so and so. I don't really come from a food background, so to speak. What was really important to my family was eating dinner. Everybody ate dinner at the same time. Everybody was at the table. We were all dragged from whatever we were doing as kids to sit down, not drink too much water or milk, and eat your food and twice the amount of whatever we had. Right. So that was really important, was family dinner. But I got into it because I was really, really bored at work. I was 20, I think 2 years old, living in the suburbs of Philadelphia, working at a asset management company. And I came from such an intense background. I was a swimmer my entire life. Everything was competitive about what I did. I still am. But I think the industry I'm in now, it really energizes me, and it keeps my competitive spirit alive, I think, a lot more than what I was doing. So I was looking for something more, and I kind of just jumped in with two feet, left my job. After looking at culinary schools for over a year, somebody said to me, do not go to culinary school unless you research it. And I was like, okay. So I started researching it. I visited a couple culinary schools, Philadelphia, New York, went to see what it was all about. It was a lot of money. And the same person said, it's like a tattoo. Do not do it unless you're sure, because I guess you can get tattoos removed now, but I'm not going to remove that loan and that debt that I'm going to get into by going to culinary school. So,
but wouldn't that be nice if you could laser remove?
Yeah.
That's another topic.
Yes. That would be amazing. So moved to New York City, completely changed my lifestyle for the good and the worse, right? I partied a lot, and really didn't know what I was doing in culinary school either. I was still trying to figure out what I did. I bought a book, like, all the culinary careers. I'm a book person, so anything I don't know or want to learn, I buy a book, or I look for a book, or I find a recommendation to figure out or teach myself how to get from A to Z, how to do this better, whatever. Dennis, my fiance, likes to call them self-help books, but it's really about figuring out, anything you want to know, from management to culinary to whatever. So I was looking at all the culinary careers I could possibly find. My culinary school was, I had, I think, like 10 or 13 people, so it was pretty small. And my chef, Chef Ted, said the best thing you can do is go and work in a kitchen. Don't go and try to work. My one friend was a assistant producer for Martha Stewart, and I was like, man, she's doing a really cool thing, and I'm not. Why? And then my other classmate went and worked in a test kitchen for Bon Appetit, and I'm like, why are they doing something so cool? And I'm like, I'm working in this kitchen. Didn't know how to speak Spanish, and everybody I worked with spoke Spanish. And it was hard. It was really hard. And I just kept kind of plugging away at it and kept, going after. And it was like, I think my dedication and drive and how athletics really shaped who I am, and my determination and my drive throughout my entire life, that it kind of just carried me through this whole next phase of being in a whole new career. So I think that's kind of what happened.
So you didn't come from a background where you were like, did you like to cook before?
Oh, cooking, yes. Yeah. So in college, I was always the one, or, with my friends, always the one planning the party, or like wanting to entertain people. And to me, I thought that was the funnest part of the whole culinary thing. Like, I wanted to get into culinary school and then go into marketing or something, because that's what I knew. But to me, what was the most exciting was kind of what you guys do too, a lot of, is I loved putting on a party and a show for people. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't know the food part about it. I didn't know the background of how to do that. And so I was like, all right, I have the business background. I know this and that, and I want to know how to put it all together. So just went to get my culinary education, had a lot of fun, ate so much food. I think I gained 25 pounds or something. We ate every single day, so much food, just being able to taste our food, the other cook's food, the dishes in school. And then, what do you do after you leave there? You go out and you find all the best restaurants to eat at. Right. So it was like nonstop.
Sounds dreamy.
Yeah, you're in New York.
Like, yeah.
Sounds dreamy to me.
It was, then you have to go buy new clothes and get afforded.
Again, you're in New York.
Well, then, yeah, that's great. So, but you got to look good too. So, I loved getting into that and learning all of that, and I really just wanted to entertain and put on a show. And so that's how I really got in and stuck with it, was learning how to cook and then figuring out how to put on that show. And my internship was with Abigail Kirsch, which is an amazing catering company. They do the Piers, Chelsea Piers,
okay,
in New York. And they had some amazing clients and an amazing organized production that was just mind-blowing. And I was so young in figuring out what I wanted to do. I don't think I took full advantage of being able to do that. But while I was there, like, the sous chef had these side gigs and he asked me if I wanted to do them. So I worked at Abigail Kirsch, went to school. I was putting on these huge weddings, doing hors d'oeuvres, not working fast enough, working like super slow because I didn't know, I had no clue what I was doing. And then on the side, I was hustling, making money under the table, working in the basement of delis that were like flooding on like these fridge freezers, like not even countertops, in like a space no bigger than your closet at home. It was, and these stairs, and you had to duck your head to get downstairs, and it was just crazy. So prepped in those little spaces and then went and put on this show in people's homes, that I had to take the subway to. I think it was like an hour away to go and like help at these events. It was, so I did a lot of weird thing, like side things. I also actually, I thought I wanted to be a travel agent at one point while I was in New York.
Wow.
Hosting, going to culinary school, doing these side gigs, doing my externship at Abigail Kirsch. I used to be an assistant for a boutique travel agent and used to go around New York City on my off days taking like pamphlets to travel agencies. And then I ended up getting a loan or a car and driving around New Jersey, like dropping off. So I was doing a lot of
things. You did it all. You're very well rounded.
So I was, I was trying to figure out really what I wanted to do. And I'm grateful for all the strange things I did.
So I have a question, because you said like you didn't have a grandfather, somebody in your family that was like, they're making pasta, or somebody maybe from your family that inspired you. But is there a particular chef that has inspired you along the way? Like somebody that you thought, or was it just the whole idea of this entertainment party kind of, I want to put on this food kind of show and make people feel like welcome to your table kind of a thing, where it was more about that than it was about feeling inspired by the food or inspired by a particular chef?
Yeah, I think the mentors and the chefs that I've worked under along the way really inspired me to do better, to be better, because they were so hard on everybody that worked there. This new generation of like cooks, and to answer your question, no, I didn't have one chef that was someone that I aspired to be. And, you know, I've talked about this before to friends and to family, and I didn't have a mentor. I really didn't have a mentor in the culinary industry. I never did. And I think that was the hardest part for me, was, you know, as a swimming, I had my idols, I had times to beat, there was specific things and goals that I could reach, and I had a coach and I had coaches, and those were my mentors, and those were the people that pushed me and drove me, and I had best friends in the industry. When I moved and went to the culinary industry, I had no friends in the industry. I was just a different type of person. I wasn't a dishwasher and then work my way up to cook. I wasn't someone who, moved to New York to make a living for my family and mail money back to them if they were living in another country. I was, you know, a white girl who went to college and then paid to go to culinary school and worked with a bunch of people who didn't have any similar background to me whatsoever. So It was really hard that I didn't have a mentor. I think the chefs that I worked under along the way pushed me to get to where I am in their background, and they had an amazing background. The first chef I ever worked for, he was an apprentice for the chef who used to work at DOM in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and they were one of the top 10 restaurants in the country at the time. And to work under someone that did that was, I think, how I saw the seriousness in food and what you can do with it and the creativity that really he had. And then it kind of just kept going where I kept working for people who kept pushing me little by little. Not someone that I really went to, because the chefs that I worked under were, you know, if you did something wrong and the food came back, you got a plate thrown at your head. Like, I've had, I can't tell you things that happened in kitchens that I was at where today it's not okay to do that. It's a different culture. We live in a very different world now, but I'm a millennial also. I'm not a millennial, but I've worked in kitchens where, you know, it's not the way it is today. It was the way it was back then when you got things thrown at you, you got kicked out of the kitchen, you got burned on purpose, and it was just a different thing. And wow. So that's why I'm always drawn to books and chefs. And there weren't I've actually never worked under a woman chef. So I didn't have like a woman mentor to be like, no, that's wrong. You need to figure out and do it this way, or you shouldn't be treated this way, or blah, 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 blah. So I didn't have any women mentors to really guide me. And I kind of just paved my way myself. And that's why I think maybe I'm a little harsh on some people, or I try to bring the best out in some people now, is that I think when people look at me, they don't realize I didn't have like a cushy, you know, from my start in the culinary industry to where I am now. I've worked so hard to get to where I am now, but you know, not all people see it or know my background, so they wouldn't assume that, or they wouldn't know that that's kind of, you know, some of the things I went through in kitchens, you would think more so people who were 10, 15, 20 years older than I am went through those things. It wasn't still happening, but it is, and it might still be, but it definitely was in some of the kitchens I used to work in.
Does that inspire you to want to be a mentor to someone who doesn't have one, so that you can kind of give them what you didn't have?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I want people to come to me to get ahead and to figure out. And you can make such a career out of this industry. There's so much for people out there. And I try to let people know that. I try to let cooks know that work with me. I try to let them know there's a path here. If you work hard, there's a path, and you can really get there and learn and elevate yourself. But part of the trouble is, I think people in this industry bounce from restaurant to restaurant for an extra dollar, and they don't take advantage of figuring out how to get a career and find a career in it and hold on and put faith and trust in the process of staying at a location for amount of time to really get to that next step. So I do really, I love being that person that somebody can go to push and get there. I love working with my cooks now. I love working with my sous chefs now. I love working with people from the front of the house now. I'll say it's the most challenging thing to work with individuals in this industry. People come from all different backgrounds. When I was working at an asset management company, you know, everybody's went to college. Everybody comes from a good family, and everybody is off on the weekends and is doing whatever. And here and in this industry, it's not like that at all. It's completely different. So you really have to learn everybody and how they work and figure out. Sometimes you got to drag it out of them. You got to pull it out of them to figure out, you can do this. How do we get there? And it is really difficult and challenging, and it's very emotionally draining to take the time to do that with individuals. But that's really what I signed up for, because at the end of the day, I'm not in there cooking all of my dishes, right? Other people are tasked to do that. Other people are learning how to make the sausage, how to make the ricotta. I'm not the one in there making all of the food. And so if I'm not a good leader and I'm not teaching, coaching, and inspiring these individuals, then your food suffers and then your guests suffer. So it's really, it really trickles down fast.
So how difficult is it to assemble a staff? Like, what is the process for that?
Oh, hiring. It's a revolving door. We're constant. It's constant. To assemble a staff of a good team, you have to have good leaders, and you have to always have your pulse on what's going on in the kitchen every single day. You can't ignore. I tell my staff, I'm like, if there's like a rain cloud over you and you're walking in the door, you better believe I'm pulling you aside to figure out what's going on, because you can't cook food unhappy and you can't be around other people and let that. I'm a big like vibes person. If you have negative energy and you're frustrated, everybody feels it. And I am not one to ignore that. You have to figure out what's going on. And this is a fun place. Like, you have to have fun doing it. Why wouldn't you have fun? You're here 10 hours cooking food. You're hot and you probably haven't eaten for the last 9 hours. So you better have, like, I got to make sure my team's having fun doing it.
Positivity is probably really important.
Yeah.
I would think so. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Reminds me of that movie did you ever see that old movie? I can't even remember the name of it. It was Sarah Michelle Gellar, where she's the chef in the kitchen, and if she cries into the food, everybody who's eating the food is crying.
Oh, no.
I need to find the name of that movie and put it in the show notes. It's hilarious. Yeah, it's funny that way.
You need to have like a team building night where you guys
watch that movie.
I know.
You know, I mean, if you could get a day off, because that's not something that's happening.
Right.
Yeah, we'll figure that one out.
It'll come. So it sounds like you definitely are, you thrive on drive.
Yeah.
You have a lot of drive. Like, you are an extremely passionate, it's not so much passionate about one particular thing as it is just you're a passionate person. Like, that's what I'm getting.
Oh, yeah.
That you're just, it's passionate about your kitchen staff. It's passionate about what you're cooking. It's passionate about just life in general, you know, really trying to make people feel encouraged and positive and just drive. It's drive.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's not like the true definition of what drive, like, you are the walking definition of drive. You've got it.
Yeah. And I push myself to the max, and I also expect that from other people too. You know, being a part of a team my entire life, being on the swim team, being on a national championship swim team, there's no like, oh, sorry. Like, to me, that doesn't exist. So when that happens in the kitchen, you know, and it happens a lot, there's no excuses. It's very cut and dry with me. You just don't accept excuses. There's no excuses. It's very black and white for me. And sometimes I can push people away because they're not used to that type of leadership. But for me, it's like you weed out the people that want to be there versus the people who don't want to be there. And everybody wants to be around the people that want to be there. So.
Sure.
So do you consider yourself more of a people pleaser, more of a perfectionist, or are you like the perfect balance of the two?
Oh, if the perfect balance is crazy, that's probably me. I'm totally a perfectionist, but I'm a big time like campaigner for anything that I believe in strongly. Mm-hmm. I won't stop like trying to convince you that, not that I'm right, but like that, hey, see it from my point of view, see it from my side. Like, I'm a big time campaigner for things like anything that I'm passionate about. So I try to end up like pulling people in my direction and persuading people to think like I do or work like I do or believe like I do. And I think that's a good thing and a bad thing always, but I'm definitely by no means perfect.
No, but it seems like not so much from a, I don't know, it's like your perspective. is one of encouragement for mm-hmm. other people, not so much to be critical or to criticize, but to kind of say, I feel like what you're saying, like you come up alongside people and say, no, you can do it. I do it. Like, let's bring you, like you're trying to bring everybody
bring
up
out
to
the best
a certain
in.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the best things, the first restaurant I've worked at in New York, the executive sous chef said to me was, I'm training you to be better than I am. You need to do this better than I do. That's the goal. That's the end goal. That's a great leader, I think, is someone that really does that. They're trying to bring the best out in people. And I want you to have my job one day. I don't want to do this forever. Your legacy is more the people that work under you, because those are the people that are going to continue inspiring and doing what you're doing. You leave an impact on every single person that works for you. And in Pittsburgh, the city is so small. So there's not one person that's worked under me that I haven't been completely real with or pushed in a way where to make them better. And, you know, you take it or leave it. And it's really, I think, impactful to every person that works in a kitchen, because it's such a hard atmosphere to work in sometimes, and it's very stressful, that there's nothing to be but like positive and wanting that person to be better than you are. That's the goal.
That's a fantastic philosophy, because I think there's probably someone everywhere who's fought against somebody who's trained them but only wanting them to go so far because they were afraid of maybe losing their position mm-hmm. or the next generation. So I think to be able to pour into the next generation of people is super important in any industry. I mean, wouldn't you say that?
Yeah.
So if you had some advice to give to somebody that was in culinary school or wanting to do this based on that, what would you say to them?
The culinary school in Pittsburgh? Is there one? Is there one?
There was one.
I don't know.
Yeah.
No, I'm
but
joking.
In general.
Oh, no. In general. No, yeah. In general. My advice. Wait, what was the question again?
Any new chef starting out, let's say that. What would you say to them? What piece of advice would you have? I have something that I think that's interesting based off what you said that I might think, but.
The quote that I had like in my room since I was like 6 years old is attitude is everything. Mm-hmm. Like you can do whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. You can take it however you want. Don't, you know, hold on to, you know, this and that or past experiences. You can do whatever you want with it. You can overcome anything. And attitude is everything in that situation.
Yeah.
And that's really what it comes down to, is if you want to do it or not. I tell all my staff to manage up. Like there's so many people that quit or leave because they weren't getting this or that, and then they leave but all you had to do was speak your mind and talk to your manager and say, hey, this wasn't working, or this, or I didn't like this. And there's so many people that don't do that. And I don't know where I was going with that, but attitude is everything. Is really the only thing that really matters to get you where you want to go.
Right. Well, you're extremely driven, like what Star said. But at the same time, when you were talking before, I feel like you were humble at the beginning too, where you started where you needed to start so that you could rise up. Where maybe some people might think they get out of culinary school, they want to be the executive chef, and there's not a lot of work ethic maybe mm-hmm. involved
like you have
in
to
that
do
process,
your time.
But you've got to do your time, which mm-hmm. you did yours, and that's probably why you are as successful as you are today. And you are so passionate, you also carry that into sustainability. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Ooh, yes.
Her eye, like the twinkle in her eyes.
I know. She's lighting up.
She's really excited.
There's more I can do every single day. There's not enough we can do.
I think a lot of people don't understand it. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah,
a lot of
sure.
people don't understand what actually it is when you say, like, oh, this is a sustainable restaurant, or this is what sustainability is. I think that people don't really realize all that encompasses, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's more than just, let's not use plastic straws or paper napkins. You know, there's a lot more to it than that. So, yeah, give us some Because this is an area where you are passionate about.
Yes, I'm very passionate about it. and it's really my fiance that got me into it, Dennis. He is super passionate. And when I think I got into it when I started Kuroda Cafe in Smallman Galley. Mm-hmm. I was the first chef group that went into Smallman Galley, and I had a choice to pick where my food came from and decide how I was going to do things. And that was the first time I had to make decisions as a chef and not be told this or that, or, you know, working for somebody else. And so my choices made an impact on the environment. And then I really just wanted to dig deeper and figure out more. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't believe in sustainability or care enough because they think they're not doing enough. There's not enough we can do. Like, oh, I'm turning my lights off today. That's not really impactful, is it? Is it not? I think there's just a lot of how much does this matter? And if I'm doing it, how many other people are doing it? And it's hard. It's really hard because we live in a world now that, you know, it's not so important, or it's not done by everybody. So for me, I think it's not just about the food. It's not I'm a chef because I'm just, you know, I've a talent with cooking, or it's more what am I going to do as a chef to change the way people think about eating sustainably. That's part of it for me. It's not about just, oh, I'm making good food. How do I make it? Oh, I'm making good food and I have to make money for the business. How am I going to do that? But adding that sustainability factor into it, it's a challenge. And I love challenges. So, and you know, it's also, it's upsetting in a way too, where I know I can't do enough, whatever I'm doing, it's not easy. And so everything that I do, is it 100% sustainable? No, it's not. It's not, because you also have a consumer and an, the industry or the city and the communities that we live in also don't think that way. Mm-hmm. So it's hard, but for me, we've, you know, reducing the use of single-use plastic is a big one. Mm-hmm. I actually helped not start, but be a part of the organization by Humane Action Pittsburgh that started the No Plastic Please, mm-hmm. Which is a campaign that they put on to stop the use of single-use plastic in Pittsburgh. And it's totally possible. Other communities and cities have done it. It's just a matter of getting out there and getting the word out there and making everybody believe or do it, or passing policy that, hey, nobody can sell single-use plastic anymore. And sometimes that's what it's going to take to really make that change, because people's choices may always be by default the cheapest option or the way they're accustomed to doing things. So reducing the use of single-use plastic is something that I'm really passionate about. Most of our garbage ends up in the ocean, and there's not enough we can do to stop that. You know, am I guilty of picking up a free bottled water or plastic? Yeah, I sure am. I'm not perfect. I'm not that person that, you know, that ideal model sustainable person, but do I strive to be? Yeah. And I think that's the most we can really do, is think about what we're doing. So for the restaurant here, Spirits and Tales, I'm consistently making people think about their choices and how we're doing things. We don't have composting here, but that's something that we're looking into. Composting is an added expense. So it all comes down to money and choices, and figuring out how to balance that. A lot of products out there that are more sustainable or compostable are more expensive. And just like the food that is organic, that's more expensive. So it comes at a cost, but I'm hoping the more and more people buy that, it lowers the cost. So
let's talk about the Oyster Recovery.
Oh, yes, the Oyster Recovery Partnership.
Yeah.
So got involved with the Oyster Recovery Partnership, which is located out of the Chesapeake Bay region. They are an organization that recycles oyster shells, and they collect donated oyster shells. So they do shell recycling from restaurants that sell oysters, mostly around that region. And about a year and a half ago, I got wind of this project. At the time, we were opening Dennis and I, Or the Whale and Merchant Oyster Company. And we were very passionate about, what do we do with these oyster shells? They shouldn't just go to a landfill. Dennis had worked with an organization before when he was in DC. So he was telling me about it. And that's when I was like, we have to make this happen. We have to make this happen. It has to, you know, we have to do something. And we didn't know how we were going to do it. But after talking to Tommy Price, who is head of that organization, we figure out a way to make Pittsburgh the pilot city for this oyster shell recycling. The logistics took a long time, working with also Sustainable Restaurants Pittsburgh, Rebecca Bicossi, who's amazing, and really helped lead the way in getting other gauging interest and figuring out the logistics with us. We, together, as we consistently pushed for this, figured out a way. And this past November 2018 was the first pickup of oyster shells from Pittsburgh. So I don't even know. And that's, I mean, I feel like it should, more people in Pittsburgh, like, who create those initiatives for clean waterways and the three rivers running through here. It obviously, we can't return these shells to the rivers here, because with the salinity levels, it's not a location for aquaculture to happen with the growing of oyster shells. So it wouldn't happen here, but we're doing something. We're doing something to rebuild the Chesapeake Bay, who's been stripped of the aquaculture, the reefs, and the oysters that grew there. And it's really important. Back when Obama was in administration, declared the Chesapeake Bay to be a national treasure. And so there was, I believe, some grants that were given to this organization, and the University of Maryland partnered with them. So just a fun fact, for every half oyster shell, 10 new baby oysters, it's a platform for 10 new baby oysters to grow on it. So if you think about how many oyster shells can be donated back to rebuild something that we've done, like, we've done it as humans, we've taken it, we need to do something for, we need to give something back. So we need to do something about it. And I feel really proud that we brought it here. But there's still so much work to be done that I'm just, you know, that's one step to me.
Right.
It's, you know, I can't go on and on about, oh my God, I did something. I didn't do anything really yet. Like, we need to do more.
Mm-hmm. But so, do you find that it's hard to get people on board with that?
No, it's free. I mean, yes and no. Like, it's, I don't think there's not a lot of places in Pittsburgh that primarily focus on oysters. But the places that do sell any oyster should be involved in this program. You have a barrel, you put the oysters in, and then it gets picked up for free. You don't do anything except recycle the shells. So to me, every single restaurant in Pittsburgh should belong to this organization and know that we're doing something for a bigger purpose.
So it's more about education than anything else.
Yep.
Which, that's why you need to get the word out, which is great. You're doing great things.
And so repeat that again, too, just from an educational perspective, because I feel like some of our listeners, as they're listening and you're talking about the Oyster Recovery Project, they're thinking like, well, what do you do? How do you recycle oyster shells? But you said for every half a shell, it produces that the possibility of 10 oysters, like they regrow.
Yes.
In the, so you put the shells back in the bay and you get 10 more out of one half a shell.
Yeah.
Like that's crazy. Mm-hmm. That's
yeah.
crazy.
Right. It's insane. Like
so how why wouldn't you want to do that?
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
And even the consumers too. And then you take a step further and you say, consumers, people who like oysters, you should be eating at these restaurants that are doing something because you're giving them the opportunity to continue donating. You should be eating at these restaurants, right? Like if I was a consumer out there, I would be interested in knowing where these oyster shells went and be eating at the places, if I loved oysters, which I do, eating at the places that do donate these shells over the places that don't. And then that's kind of where it goes down this rabbit hole of, you know, where my food comes from. And then people start thinking about it more.
Yeah. Well, how about as a consumer, if you are enjoying oysters at a restaurant, maybe that you've been going to for a long time, and maybe they're not even aware of what that is. How about you as a regular consumer at that restaurant, why not ask and say, hey, have you ever heard of the Oyster Recovery Project? Do you guys participate in that? Did you know that it's this, you know, it's a free thing to participate in? Like it requires, really, honest to goodness, it requires nothing. You're throwing them in the trash. Just throw them in a barrel instead. They're being picked up for nothing.
Yep.
And you are, like, what you're doing, I mean, that seems better to me than recycling plastics. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're getting 10 more out of a half a shell.
Yeah, and just like, that simple conversation is important. It's really important. And consumers do make a difference. If somebody here came and suggested something, you know, and then the next person came and suggested the same thing, you think twice and say, oh, maybe this is something we should be involved in too.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So before we wrap up this interview, and I hate to wrap it up because it's fun, I do want to talk a little bit about your food here at Spirits and Tales. So what is your favorite thing that you make on the menu that you offer?
Oh boy.
What do you recommend to come and eat?
I hate picking. I know this is, I admire the chefs who have this, I don't know, I feel like I'm just the worst at it, but who have this like script that this is what I recommend, this and this, and every time I pick something different because I'm like, I have to distribute the love to all of the dishes. No, I would say to me, the horseradish gnocchi, which is something I had at Kuroda Cafe, it's a little bit different here. It's a Parisian style, so we don't have potato in it. It is a cooked dough that we pipe into a pot of boiling water. But the horseradish gnocchi is definitely one of my favorites. It has so much flavor and it's vegetarian. But yeah, that and, you know, Spirits and Tales, the point and purpose of the menu is it kind of fits with the space as well as, you know, there's lounge seating and then there's bar seating and it's very intermixed and intermingled. So there's a lot of movement in the space with the lobby being up here as well. But having a lot of small plates in the menu kind of goes hand in hand with that space because we have a big focus on the bar program as well. And to be able to share and try different things at my table is really what I want people to get out of dining here.
And we love that. We love like the whole small plate thing because our tendency is to go to a restaurant and it's hard to pick. You think like there are so many restaurants in Pittsburgh and we're trying to hit all of these different places all the time. And so you're thinking, but I might not get this because if the chef changes the menu. So we will order multiple plates of like copious amounts of food that you cannot consume. So having the option to have like multiple small plates
is really nice.
Or yeah, and so that you get a taste of everything. We love that. That's really great.
Yeah, for sure. And your cooking is very vegetable forward, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
Does that come from being an athlete?
Yes, it does. A lot of how I think about food comes from you know, the way I like to eat personally. And I think it's the way a lot of people like to eat too. And I don't think we see enough of it here in Pittsburgh. So there's that. And also I really enjoy, I had a great, you know, experience and as a cook working at restaurants with French cuisine, and I had a French chef who spoke in French, so he really taught me a lot about French food, and it's really kind of stuck with me. I mean, it's the mother of all culinary language is French, so that and you know, you have to make things taste good. And to go back to the healthy, I really, really hate leaving a restaurant, waking up the next day and feeling it.
Yes.
And feeling like
food
crap.
Hangover. The food hangover. Yeah. Yes.
I hate
swollen.
That. Yeah. I really do. And honestly, that's how I judge some restaurants too. And I want people to leave my restaurant feeling good about what they ate. It's good ingredients. You know, I do try to source organically when possible. I do make sure that all the meat is local. It's no antibiotics, no hormones. That's important to me because we were having this conversation before. It's a very personal thing for people to put this food in their body. It's going in their body. It's not, you know, when you dive down to it, it affects this person's health. So I like to make sure that the ingredients that we source and we use don't make you feel like crap.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah, that is.
I think more people need to think that
Absolutely.
Way for sure.
We've been to places countless times before you exit the restaurant. I mean, we're a little bit older, so maybe that's part of it. But you're already feeling swollen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, you already feel like, not great, you know? I mean, some of that could have to do with the fact that you're eating
right.
more than you normally do, because we try to eat healthy on a daily basis.
I was just gonna say that.
And so when we go out, anytime we go out, it feels indulgent to us. But that idea that, you know, I don't want you to wake up in the morning and feel like crap. You know, that is super important to us too. And the food here is amazing.
It's incredible.
Amazing.
You have to try it. If you've not been to Spirits and Tales
Thank
in Oakland, you.
You
have to try it.
For sure. Now let's ask just a couple of fun questions before we wrap up.
Yes.
So one word
My
answers.
My favorite part.
Okay. No explanation,
answers.
Just one word answers.
Okay.
All right. Beer or wine?
Wine.
Yes, girlfriend. I knew you were
Kindred
team
spirits.
Wine. Yeah. Kindred spirits. Waffles or pancakes?
Ooh, pancakes.
Savory or sweet?
Savory.
All right, we're going to switch over to sweet, though. Let's go cake or pie?
Pie.
I love a good buttery pie crust.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Duck Just, fat pie
yeah.
crust.
That's the French influence.
Yeah, there you go.
So, Jen, we have one more question. It's not like a silly little question, but just one more thing, because we always say when we start our podcast, we always say,
welcome to our table.
So Jen has a question to pose that.
Yeah. So if you're welcoming people to your table, who are you with and what are you serving?
Oh, God.
Your perfect table.
I usually have to plan this stuff out. who am I with? And what's on my table?
Yes.
I mean, the thing that comes to mind where I spend most of my time is... Dennis is at my table. And we have a roasted chicken. A perfectly roasted chicken with vegetables. That is my...
And a bottle of wine?
And a bottle of wine? Maybe two.
What kind of wine?
Ooh.
Are you white?
So,
red,
yes.
Rosé, or are you all of the above?
Rosé. And I've been into red lately, but I don't discriminate. Everything.
Same.
Everything.
All the wine.
Hashtag all the wine. Hashtag all the wine.
Yeah, so we
hashtag
wanna...
that was basic, but yes.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah.
We know you're with us.
Yeah, we know you're with us. Team wine. Hashtag team wine.
So we want to encourage all of our listeners to visit Spirits and Tales if you're local to the Pittsburgh area, and say hello to Chef Jessica Lewis if possible when you're in. Tell
Please
her you heard
by.
About her.
Yeah.
Yeah, on our podcast. Star, if anyone has any questions or wants to get a hold of us, how do they do that?
You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. We are at Gorman Brothers. Gourmandburg, GOURMANDBURGH. You can send us an email at IamStar@Gourmandburg or at GourmandburgGirls.com. And you are?
I am Jen at Gourmandburg or GourmandburgGirls.com. And if you would be so kind to rate and review us on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen to our podcasts or to any podcast, yeah, that helps people find us, and we appreciate that.
Jessica, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much,
time.
Jen and Star. Yeah, I've never met a Star before.
You have
Jen, you're just as fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much, ladies.
Thank you. Thanks so much. All right, we will talk with you all again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.